Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, April 9th, 2015. Many topics to cover tonight, so I'll be talking quickly. First, a couple notices. A water filter sale on my page, and this is due to the fact that the new factory has come online to produce 100% in the United States the water filter elements. These are the candles, the white filter ceramic elements, and previously they were manufactured in England, which caused importation, delays, trying to coordinate international supplies, and so now this is all being done in the United States, new, brand new factory, etc., come online. So, in honor of this, and I'm so happy because you just don't even, you can't even imagine, you might be able to if you're in business and you deal with international issues and exchange rates and customs and importation and paperwork and, oh my goodness, you couldn't even imagine. Okay, so no more. So in honor of this, I'm putting a special up on the webpage. Now, already there was a 10% reduction in price on special items, especially the shortwave offer number 2. And, there are many of the major items on the webpage that had a 10% discount. So those all are already there. But the two items where you can get the special deal here is the shortwave offer number 2. That's the stainless steel canister. It comes with 4 GF. These are the filter elements that have all of the filtration in them. It has for fluoride, arsenic. It has for the heavy metals, aluminum, for the chemicals, for the pharmaceuticals. The GF filter remove all of these without any add-ons. But at any rate, those are primarily that's what people are buying today. Every now and then somebody buys the old style filters and they still use those and they put the add-on filters on. And to be honest with you, I still use those. And so if you're in a situation where, for example, you're getting your water from a beautiful mountain stream and you just want to make sure there's no bacteria in the water, you know, those are perfectly fine. And I use those. I have some of my remote places where I have water filters. I use those. So there's still a use. But by and large, the majority of people today are buying the GF filters. So anyway, that's what I want to concentrate on. So here's the deal. You're already getting a 10% discount on the shortwave offer number 2. That's the stainless steel container with 4 GF filters included. You already get a 10% discount, regular retail, $300. You get a 10% discount, so $269. But then we're going to throw in 2 extra GF filters. And that's an $84 freebie right there. And plus, you don't have to pay for the shipping for the second filters, so that's $84 combined, $70 for the 2 filters and $14 shipping, so you save that, and we're throwing those in for free at the 10% discount price. Or, if you buy a 10-pack of the GF filters, which retail, full retail, is $333 with the 10% discount, which is the sale that's on the page, the sales page right now, that's like $299, and then we're going to throw in 2 extra of the GF filters. Or if you buy both the shortwave offer number 2 and the 10 pack of filters, we're going to throw in not 4 but 6 extra GF filters. So not only do you get the 2 and 2, but we're throwing in 2 extra for a total of 6. So you better go to the webpage and buy these before I get my sanity back and take that sale down. But anyway, I'm very, very happy that these GF filters are now being produced in the United States. They're NSF certified. They can be sold in all 50 states. And I'm not going to spend any more time. Go to the webpage. All the details are there. jmccsci.com. Also, just a one-liner, my new DVD number 4 is out there selling. and getting reactions from the people that they're very happy with this. The DVD number 4, it's basically a restructuring of cosmology, and this is number 4 of 20. And that's all I can tell you. Go to the webpage. The course outline is there. This is university-level astronomy, astrophysics, space science material. Very detailed. There's 7 hours of lecture. There's written material. There's a lot of photos. There's exercises. There's 25 seriously difficult problems. But not that everybody is going to solve all these problems in the problem set, but it's going to make you think and understand that I have solved these problems and that the redirection of cosmology is very important. Okay, so anyway, that's DVD number 4, also on the sales page. Okay, here's an article that just came out yesterday. And it says that Mars, they're really working this Mars issue. And obviously my success at convincing the people that there are oceans of water. So anyway, here's what the article says. It says that Mars, they have done satellite radar surveys of the surface of Mars. And I saw one of the maps, they have these blotch marks of glaciers, supposedly all over the surface of Mars. They said enough water to cover Mars 1 meter deep over its entire surface. And I'm going, you know, that's a serious amount of water. And so then it turns out that this is calculated. Somebody calculated that there was that much water under the dust and sand and dirt of Mars. So they've done radar mapping. And then made some calculations and determined that there was water there. But at the end of the article, I'm going to read some of this because it's just so outrageous. It says, the ice at the mid-latitudes is therefore an important part of Mars' water resource, a reservoir. This is the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. And then it says, scientists have been trying to figure out how Mars transformed from a warm, wet, and presumably Earth-like planet early in its history into the cold, dry desert that exists today. And, of course, then they say billions of years ago, and that word, what rabbit hat they get this out of, billions of years ago, they say, Mars, which lacks a protective global magnetic field, lost much of its atmosphere. And now, where do they come up with this? Billions of years ago. That's just, it's ridiculous. It says, several initiatives are underway to determine how much of the planet's water was stripped away and how much remains locked in the ice in underground reservoirs. Now, here's the next statement. This is the clincher. It says, the atmospheric pressure on Mars is too low that water ice simply evaporates and becomes water vapor, the Institute said in the news release. Okay, boys and girls. First of all, they're telling you there's enough water in ice on Mars, supposedly under protective dirt and dust, but then the atmospheric pressure is so low that water simply turns to water vapor. That's called sublimation. So how in the world is this dust supposedly protecting the water ice from turning into vapor? I mean, it's a pressure issue. How is the dust sitting on top of the ice protecting it from low atmospheric pressure? This is beyond absurd. And so then they refer to the NASA announcement of just a couple weeks ago that Mars had lost 80% of its atmosphere due to examining atmospheric composition of Mars. And then this is the clincher. The very last statement, it says, currently the planet's largest known water reservoir is at the polar caps. But we know that the polar caps, there is an extremely small amount of water there in the polar caps that evaporate and then reform every year. But the majority of the polar caps is carbon dioxide, not water. It's dry ice. And so, anyway, it drives me crazy, these scientists, It is just so ridiculous. And then I'll just briefly mention this also, giving an update on the Rosetta spacecraft at Comet 67P. They show a picture of activity around the comet nucleus and claim that it is the icy comet sublimating material. But, you know, clearly there's no ice or water on the surface of this comet. And so, once again, these are tonal, very exaggerated photos of material in the vicinity of the comet nucleus. And what they're saying is that the satellite now, the Rosetta satellite, is having trouble keeping position because of debris, which its star sensors, which are used for maintaining position, are seeing dust particles that are illuminated, and therefore it's getting off kilter. But I'll tell you something else. Something that is happening is it's interacting with the electric fields of the electric current, the discharge of the solar capacitor, the electron current that's coming in, especially electrons from the sunward side, and causing the induced electric dipole force. This is something I discussed in my Saturn Sweeper Moon paper, which was peer-reviewed, published in 1981 in a journal called The Moon and the Planets. That's when I was at Cornell. And I discussed the induced electric dipole force on a spacecraft. And what happens is let's take a Campbell's soup can just as an example. Okay, now this Campbell's soup can, which is a kind of a primitive example of a metal spacecraft, there's a lot of metal, there's a lot of conductors, there's electric circuitry, etc., in the structure of the satellite, and of course it's a much more complicated shape. But the Campbell's soup can demonstrate as an example. What happens is that in a non-uniform electric field, and that's what we have at a comet, or in the comet electron beam, we have a concentration of electrons, therefore surrounding that is a non-uniform electric field. There are also magnetic fields, which are a result of the moving charges and the pinched currents, etc., around the comet. But here we're talking about unshielded electrical charge, electric fields, non-uniform, meaning that they're not in a two-plate capacitor with a nice even uniform electric field. They are non-uniform because we're dealing with point sources. And so what happens to the Campbell's soup can in our example? Well, the electrons are free to move in the metal, in the can, just like in the spacecraft. And so the electrons are pushed away because of the negative charge on the comet nucleus. So the electrons go to one side of the Campbell's soup can. That leaves the other side, the close side to the comet nucleus and the electron beam, leaves the close side positively charged. But there's a balance there. There's not a net negative or positive charge. There's a net zero charge on the can, on our Campbell's soup can. But the negative charge has moved away, and the positive charge remains closer. And so what happens, there's a slightly greater attractive force on the positive charge that's left in the one end of the can than repulsive force on the electrons, which are bunched up on the other end of the can. And so what happens, this is a differential force. That's what the induced electric dipole force is all about. And by the way, that's also partially the theoretical work for the induced electric dipole redshift, which is one of my early discoveries also, that the redshift in the universe is due to non-uniform electric fields around fusion-based objects. I talk a lot about that in my new course, DVD number 4. In fact, it's understanding cosmology. You have to understand redshifts and understanding how all of the data that we have on basically galaxies, distant stars, etc., comes into play. Understanding some experiments that have never been published. Anyway, that's DVD number 4. dealing with restructuring of cosmology. But back to the Rosetta mission. Okay, so that force causes literally, because the electrons and the protons, the positive charge in the Campbell soup can, are attached to the can, they're inside the can, they create a slight attractive force. And on a spacecraft that has all kinds of metal in it, it's going to cause torques and forces unevenly on that spacecraft, keeping it out of alignment. And so at any rate, if they were getting hit by particles to the degree that it was knocking the spacecraft off kilter, they would be getting a lot more damage. But the real reason for them getting knocked off kilter is the electron, induced electric dipole force on the metal spacecraft. But of course, they don't know about that. So we get this, oh, it's getting hit by little stone type things. And I'm sure it is. I'm sure that it's getting hit by little stones. And that could be a contributing factor. But it's just ongoing garbage, bad science being brought to you by very expensive equipment. But I guarantee you that the Tier 1 people up there are sitting there chortling in their coffee, laughing at these people who are still looking at this, thinking it's a dirty snowball. But remember that misinformation is very important, and that's what's pawned off on you, the public. It's very expensive. It's very costly. But by the way, when you print money without bound, hey, there's no real expense there. Another announcement. The Russians hacked into the IRS database. Many of you people probably already know about this. And so also this past week, dealing with computer, cyber protection, etc., little Obama, the middle management of the world bankers, the pretend president in the United States, said he has inaugurated a cyber crime law, and that the government is manage cyber crime and go after criminals and give them all kinds of jail sentences, etc. But now let's look at what's really going on. First of all, the government is the reason why there is cyber crime, because the NSA and the CIA and other government agencies require that software companies put a backdoor into the software, into your operating systems, etc. That's what the whole thing with Billy Gates was about a number of years ago. And Billy broke down. Somebody took him in the back room and said, Billy, you got lots of billions, but you don't have really any money compared to the Rothschilds. And so you either play ball or bad things are going to happen to you, Billy. And so you got two choices, play ball or bad things happen to you. So Billy played ball and let the government backdoor into the Windows operating systems and everything else that Microsoft puts out. And so anyway, that's what that was all about. And then Billy got all kinds of benefits, including being able to buy into an almost completely government-sponsored large telescope facility in South America. So Billy got his own private big telescope to watch Planet X as it comes in. Okay, so anyway, the computer problems are really caused by the government, and it's those same backdoors that hackers use to get into your computer, to put in viruses and malware into your computer. So the whole issue here, if you're going to go after cybercrime, well, go after the government, the people who caused all of this. And my book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, goes into a lot of detail, so I'm not going to repeat that, but read that book. That's a very important one. It's based on my Calculate Primes book, which very quickly you can create the tables of prime numbers almost out to infinity. It happens very quickly with the generator function. After 20 iterations of the generator function, you've already identified 98% of all primes all the way to infinity. Within 100 iterations of the generator function, you have produced, you've identified 99.9% of all prime numbers all the way out to infinity. So it's a very rapid process, and it allows for very rapid breaking of the RSA codes, which are based on prime numbers. Okay, so at any rate, but the other problem with the Obama plan is it allows the government to go after people based on cyber crime. Now, if, say, you have a website and you are saying something that the government doesn't want you to say, well, that's the shoe in the door. They always create a law, and then the intent of it comes down the line at some evening session of Congress in the back page of some bill, which adds on another dimension to a law like cybercrime. And all of a sudden, if you're talking about the wrong thing, that doesn't, you know, it's against the government's book of permitted subjects or topics or interpretations or whatever, then all of a sudden, and then what they do is they can lock up your bank funds, and then you have to go and fight the government. Of course, you don't have any money because they've locked up all your bank funds, so how are you going to go fight the government to get your money back? So anyway, it's a game out there. It's getting tougher and tougher to be normal. And so anyway, it's just is very strange. I'm going to talk quickly about something called fast radio transients. And this was sent in by a listener. Fast radio transients are short radio bursts from outer space. And it's a topic that's just beginning to be studied. Somebody asked me to do a commentary on this, and really the scientific papers are very, tenuous at this point. There's really not a lot of information. The repetitive nature of these radio bursts is somewhat sketchy at best. There seems to be a pattern that's identifiable, but that's all I'm going to say at this time. There's really not enough information to make any kind of determination. But if you want to look that up, they're called fast radio transients, kind of an esoteric topic dealing with radio signals from outer space. Going back to the Mars issue, when we're talking, and I always love this, when scientists in one camp, like the planetary camp, make a statement like the low atmospheric pressure on Mars does not allow solid ice to exist. It would just turn into vapor. Well, let me tell you, folks, boys and girls, and NASA scientists and European Space Agency scientists, the atmospheric pressure on a comet is far less. And to think that somehow rock or dust is somehow going to protect ice from that vacuum of outer space and protect the water from evaporating into outer space is pure mythology. And that is one of the main issues with, you know, you understand that the Dirty Snowball Comet model, the NASA model for, they keep repeating this, the very last thing they said in the Rosetta mission article, when they talked about it being buffeted around by little particles, the last thing they said was they had to get in a plug about that little icy wanderer out there. But the reality is that they have not seen any snow or ice or water on the comet nucleus. And so their model, of course, simply doesn't work. And when they meet little particles around the comet nucleus, they assume that this is coming off the nucleus. They see activity around the nucleus, but that doesn't mean it's coming off the nucleus. And I'm sure they're all sitting there seeing data that's contradictory to the Dirty Snowball Comet model, not the least of which is there isn't any water or ice. There's just some dust in the area. The issue is that there cannot be water ice on a object with low surface pressure, low atmospheric pressure. But let's go back, and now we're dealing with another contradiction, and I want to talk about Ceres. Still no pictures out of NASA. It was announced that the planetary science the Lunar and Planetary Society had a meeting where these scientists were giving a presentation, and they did not, when they were talking about Ceres, these are the scientists that have all the data from Ceres, they would not release even a single photo of Ceres to the Planetary, Lunar and Planetary Society meeting. So they are hiding something, very definitely, and I'm sure it has to do with these bright spots that were detected as far away as Earth. And Earth-based telescopes, they could see these bright spots, and also the Hubble Space Telescope, which is, I would call, Earth-based because it's located in orbit around Earth, that they were detecting bright spots on the surface of Ceres. And now as they got closer, the one dribble of information that did come out before the complete blackout of information on Ceres was that the as the craters in which these bright spots were located, as the craters moved into dusk and nighttime so that there was no more sunlight shining on the craters, the light still continued. And they faded as the as Ceres turned into turned around and the craters turned into nighttime. So what I'm suspecting is that they're getting a real good dose of plasma discharge comet activity with electrical discharges connecting into these craters. Possibly they change. Possibly some light up one time and then another one lights up another time. But I suspect what's going on is these are conduction paths, electrical conduction paths, which go down into Ceres, possibly a vein of metal or other conductive material, and that's where the electrical discharges are connecting. But beyond that, I'm not going to speculate, but I can tell you something. By the time you see those pictures, they are going to be thoroughly, thoroughly photoshopped. Now, let me just give an example. On my webpage, down on the middle column, Thought of the Day, scroll down, I have a picture, actually two pictures of the planet Mercury. One is with a certain tone. Now, tone, let's talk about qualities of colors and pictures. There's contrast, there's tone, there's color range, and so if you're photoshopping, you can vary all of these things. You can make things that are blue into red. You can take altitudes and turn them into various colors, so you can create a topographic colored map. So you can change all of these factors back and forth, but tone has to do with it's a property of colors and also shades of black and white. And so by changing just the tone of a picture, that one factor, you can make qualities or parts of the image actually completely disappear. So what I'm saying is that's just one way to take a photo which shows some quality of, for example, a planetary surface, and change the tone a little bit or some other property of the image and make part of it completely disappear. And you can see that in the Mercury photos. The lower one has a different tone. It's much lighter. The top photo in the picture, it's not the picture of the day, it's the thought of the day, which is down below, in the center column. But the top photo of the planet Mercury has a tone that's adjusted to be darker. And so, and you can see the electrical discharges very well. You can see them extremely well in the photo. But in the lower photo, they're hardly visible at all. You have to really strain to see them. But anyway, that's what I'm trying to tell you is that, yeah, when we see those pictures of Ceres, if we ever do, it's been well over a month and a half. And normally, I remember back in the days of the Voyagers going out to Jupiter, oh man, they couldn't put enough pictures in National Geographic and the Discover magazine. Everybody was putting pictures all over the place and how wow, NASA this. You know, and it's very impressive. But I give the credit to the engineers who build those amazing spacecraft, not the Carl Sagan space scientist guys who misinterpret the data. So let me just make it clear. I criticize a lot of people, but I would never criticize those engineers who are in there building those amazing robotic satellites that go out and visit these planets, etc. So anyway, that yet to come. Just another quick comment. Washington trying to woo Cuba. Very interesting. Trying to take Cuba off the countries which sponsor terrorists. And Fidel, actually, who's elderly, of course, Fidel Castro, came out of his silence. Very infrequently do you hear him talk. And he said that he's always open to talking with any nation, no matter how adversarial they have been, such as the United States, which is just, and this is all about the boycott that's been going on, the sanctions that have been going on for over 50 years in Cuba. and Fidel goes, yeah, we'll talk to anybody. You know, the route to discussion is always open. But he doesn't trust the United States political system. And so I wouldn't either. If I were Fidel, I wouldn't trust them. And of course, he's been almost assassinated how many times by the CIA, and they're trying to mess with the Cuban government. And to his credit, Cuba is one of the most stable economies, sustainable economies on the planet today. And for example, all of the countries, all of the Latin American countries, are going to Cuba. They're sending their doctors and dental students to Cuba. Cuba has the best medical and dental schools in the Western Hemisphere. And that's where, for example, there's over 2,000 doctors from Cuba in Venezuela right now. And that's part of the problem is that they're trading, Venezuela is trading oil for other services and goods, such as doctors and dentists, to bring the people of Venezuela out of the dirt. But at any rate, just very interesting. I don't expect Cuba to buy off on, you know, letting hordes of Americans in for tourism or whatever. If they do, they'll be locked off in some corner where they can take their money and feed them rum and send them, pack them in the airplane, send them back home. But at any rate, yeah, Cuba's not up for Western culture. It's really not. It's a place that has avoided the bankers and the Barbie dolls, let's put it that way. I met a woman who was a medical doctor, a family practitioner doctor. Now, this is the kind of doctor that deals with the daily medical issues in Cuba. 13 years this woman was a doctor in Cuba, and she talked about her life as a doctor in Cuba. And so I naturally spent a lot of time talking about this, interviewing this woman, and let me tell you, she's had some stories, and now she lives with her husband in the United States. But let me give an example of a story she told. She was living near Washington, D.C., in fact, and on Christmas Eve, the police came and took the neighbors, a black family across the street from where she lived, took them and threw them out of their house into the street on Christmas Eve because they were being evicted. She said in Cuba that would never, ever happen. You would never throw people out on the street. And on Christmas Eve was just like beyond reproach. She couldn't believe that she was living in the United States and that was she was actually witnessing that happening. When the housing crisis hit and hundreds of thousands of families were thrown out of their house that they had been paying on, the money to save the banking system went into the pockets of a few New York bankers, and the AGU bailout, just on and on with the corruption, greed, and political maneuvering between the banks and the politicians, etc. You know, it's just beyond any reasonable. I mean, the devil is well at work in the United States. That's all I can tell you. But it's very interesting, the insight. A lot of the Americans do not have a clue what it's like inside that small island 90 miles off the shore of Florida. Okay, on with the scientists, the main science topic tonight, talking about the heat of formation of planets. And now this is a very interesting topic because standard planetary science tries to tell you that planets form because of gravitational collapse of dust clouds, that somehow they fall into a rotating pattern, and that's how the planets form. Well, there's a few problems with this. The most basic ones deal with simple rotational dynamics, what you call Keplerian dynamics or Newtonian dynamics, 1 over r squared forces, gravitational forces. And what happens, let's just take an example, something close to home. Let's take Earth in its orbit around the sun. And then let's look at Mars, which is farther out from the sun. Mars moves slower in its orbit than Earth does, and it takes a much longer time. It has a longer distance to go, and it moves slower. Jupiter moves slower. Jupiter takes 10 years to get around the sun. And not only does it have a longer path to go, but it moves much more slowly. And that's because as you get farther away from the sun, which is the main gravitational hub of our solar system, things move more slowly. Now, let's look at this alleged collapsing dust cloud where dust is rotating. Now, NASA has some animated footage, and I always love their animation, where things just happen to be animated to turn out just like the movie Cinderella, where everything has a happy ending. And by the way, I've seen 2 Disney movies lately, and I suppose like everybody, I'm a kid at heart, but the movie Frozen, oh my goodness, what a wonderful movie. This Disney is putting out some super quality, and then Cinderella, which just came out, I guess, in March. But amazing. The Cinderella, I was truly amazed at. If you haven't seen this, go see it twice. Just absolutely the special effects and the talent that went into that, just truly the top of the line Disney movie. But anyway, okay, enough of that. The animation, this is what's interesting, is that NASA a long time ago started hiring Disney animators. And so at a certain point, very early in the space program, the unmanned space program, they started using animation. And by the way, just going back to Ceres, the only picture I could find of Ceres, the little minor planet between Mars and Jupiter, the one I was just talking about, was an animated picture where it looked like a little mouth blowing smoke out the side of the planet. And I'm going, this is really a picture. And the article said, amazing pictures or extraordinary pictures coming from NASA's Dawn mission at Ceres. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, this isn't a real picture. This can't even be real. Because it had billowing smoke coming out of these little holes, and Ceres doesn't have an atmosphere to cause billowing smoke. And so I'm going, what is this? And so finally at the very bottom, it said this was a painting at some planetarium. Anyway, animation. And so let's go back to the formation of the solar system animated by Disney animators for NASA. And as the dust cloud coalesces into the planets, they magically turn so that the outer material away from the sun goes faster. Now, that's backwards. If the dust clouds collapsed according to true Newtonian Keplerian mechanics, 1 over r squared forces, etc., the planets would all spin backwards, but since NASA knows they all spin forward, this magical animation can make them all spin forward. Isn't that special? So anyway, that's the very first thing with the formation of the solar system from a collapsing dust cloud, actually called the Laplacian. This was first discussed by a guy named Laplace back in the, was it the 1700s? I forget. When the, and that is still the reigning theory that is that you will find in a college-level astronomy textbook. I know, I taught college, university-level astronomy. I had to grit my teeth when I had to teach this material. But then I would also explain to the students how this really worked. So at any rate, but there is another problem with the this entire scenario of formation of a solar system from a dust cloud. As these things grow, then the story is that small particles coalesce, and then eventually these start slamming together to form the planets. So that they call it the early period of bombardment, is what the official term is in astronomy, if you read an astronomy textbook. That's the official term that is used. So what's the problem here? Well, there's no atmosphere or oceans. There's no water. There's no volatiles. Because, and then they said, well, to explain the formation of oceans and atmosphere, they said, well, it must have come on a comet, and that the comets individually came in, hit Earth, and then deposited the water. But there's a little problem. When you have individual impacts, I don't care if they're little or medium-sized or even large, first of all, there's no water ever detected on or atmosphere that comes in on a comet. And that statement by a planetary scientist dealing with Mars that, hey, the low atmospheric pressure on Mars doesn't even allow ice to exist on Mars. And so so how could you have all of this water coming into Earth on little dirty snowball comets? And I'll explain how this works in just a minute. Okay, so with the plasma discharge comet model, the atmosphere, Venus is a perfect example, but I'll be explaining that in a minute. The issue with the collapsing dust cloud and then the impact theory is that when each item comes in and impacts, there's so much energy involved that any volatiles, water, any type of gases, anything that would form an atmosphere, would be superheated and would escape from that environment. And then it's molten hot. You have this super molten hot rock that's self-gravity pulling it into a sphere. And but there's, as the individual impacts occur, there's no way to keep an atmosphere during this process. So you end up with a planet with no atmosphere. Mercury is the only real planet that doesn't have an atmosphere, and that's because it's so close to the sun that it just gets blasted by solar heating, by the solar wind from the sun. It just gets it's a severe, severe environment. So little Mercury, closest planet to the sun, does not have an atmosphere. But look at Venus, much closer to the sun than Earth, and it has an atmosphere 100 times more intense, more dense, and 100 times more atmosphere than Earth's atmosphere. Venus is smaller than Earth. It's quite a bit smaller than Earth. So how did Venus acquire this amazing atmosphere that's so hot? And now let's go back and do a basic college physics problem. How long can a planetary atmosphere hold in? How long can a planet with a certain surface gravity hold an atmosphere? And the answer is a bit complicated, but it's related to the atmospheric temperature, one of the factors. The hotter the atmosphere, the more of the atmosphere that escapes much faster, because the distribution of velocities in the it's a statistical problem, the distribution of velocities at a given temperature, you have the high-end tail of the distribution curve, and those molecules escape and never come back. They're beyond the escape velocity, and so Venus, if you do the calculations, would not hold that atmosphere for very long at all, which tells you that Venus is a young planet. Okay, but the issue here is that with a formation of by impact, this early impact scenario of standard science, you wouldn't have any atmosphere at all. So the question is, how did Venus get this tremendously hot atmosphere? How did the surface of Venus become so hot that it's hot enough to melt lead? The scenarios that they create, if you take them even to the first level thinking they don't work, the second level they really don't work at all. So let me explain, just to finalize that discussion, standard science has no explanation for how atmospheres or oceans form on planets or moons. For example, Titan. Let me qualify that. Earth's moon does not have an atmosphere, and there's quite a few moons in the solar system without atmospheres, significant atmospheres. But the planets, the bigger guys, all have atmospheres. Mars has a very sparse one, but what happened to Mars? Well, just a few thousand years ago, a very large comet, and that was the proto-planet-forming planet Venus that came by, and ripped the atmosphere off of Mars. And that's because the surface gravity of the planetary part of Venus, which was the nucleus of that comet, is larger than the surface gravity of Mars. So Venus the comet won the tug of war. When Venus the comet came by Earth, Earth's surface gravity was larger. So once the electrical connection began and the now it was a toss-up. It was a fight between the two planets, Earth and Venus, the forming planet Venus. But Earth had the higher surface gravity, so Earth won, and we had a tremendous pollution event. The hydrocarbons, the burning naphtha, the rain of brimstone and fire that the ancients talk about, this is all cometary activity, the rain of fire. And what happens? Why did the naphtha burn in the air? Well, it hit the oxygen in the atmosphere, and the meteorites coming in ignited it. So you had a tremendous amount of hydrocarbon activity falling into the Earth, and the ancients talk about this. But at any rate, Earth and Mars has doubled its atmosphere in the past 10 years. We know that from NASA scientists. When the comet sighting spring came by Mars increased its atmosphere. It had a big deposit of metals into the Martian atmosphere from sighting spring. And did that come out of the little comet tail? No, that's because Mars connected into the discharge of the solar capacitor and became a comet. And so at any rate, we also know this when Comet Lovejoy came by Mars, we actually observed the Martian Mars to act like a comet. It had an expanded atmosphere visible from Earth. And so the interaction of a planet with a comet is one way to very quickly gain atmosphere, or in the case of Mars, lose it. But the planets are continually discharging the solar capacitor and gaining atmosphere. We know that Earth is gaining water all the time. How many times have I pointed out during severe storm systems that all of a sudden develop over, say, the upper Midwest of the United States, or over, say, Siberia or Russia or other parts, land masses of the Earth over Africa, that you can see the moisture content coming in off the oceans. In the case of Africa, you have that westerly moving set of belts of severe thunderstorms that move across Central Africa. Well, that water, you can detect the amount of water coming in off the Indian Ocean, south of Madagascar, basically around Madagascar, on the eastern side of Africa. You can determine from satellite data the amount of water coming into Africa. And so all of that water during the rainy season in Africa, and then coming out and moving into the hurricane season in the Atlantic during the June to November time frame, all of that water in Africa doesn't come from the Indian Ocean. The majority of that water comes from outer space, and that's due to the electrical connections of those thunderstorms into the ionosphere. And those connect electrically like little comet tails attaching to the upper atmosphere, sticking out into space, drawing in that water. So Earth is constantly drawing in water. compared to the total volume of water on Earth, it's very small. It's a very small amount. And most of that gets cycled up to the poles. It's a hydrological cycle that I determined many years ago. And if that hydrological cycle continued depositing water from the Earth, and if Earth didn't have a replenishing source of water, we would soon have most of the oceans locked up in the polar ice caps. It's a hydrological cycle where the water evaporates, goes up into the clouds, falls, and then cycles up again. And as that happens, it moves northward every time by maybe 500 miles. So this hydrological cycle is moving the water of the Earth up to the poles. And I've given accounts of stories like during World War II, a series of propeller fighter craft during World War II were on a mission up north of the Arctic Circle. They had to make an emergency landing, and then the pilots were saved. They knew where they were. They went and got them out. They flew them out. But the planes stayed there. And so the pilots, you know, I don't know how many years ago this was. This is probably back in the 1990s. They said, hey, let's go back and get those planes out. Because, you know, the old World War II pilots, they wanted to keep flying those planes. And they thought, well, they're just sitting there. We can go salvage them. All we got to do is go turn them on. Basically, there's nothing wrong with them. They've been in a deep freeze for 45, 50 years. And so anyway, they go up there to find them. They knew exactly where to go. The planes weren't there. So they're like, well, you know, nobody stole our planes. What's with it? So they figured out that they had to be down in the ice. So they started digging. And they went down. I can't remember how far down they went. But in those 50 years, these planes had been buried in you know, 100 feet of ice. That's how much ice is being deposited at the poles. And that's why we know also that the North and the South Pole are recent, probably not more than a few thousand years old, the current polar ice caps. But at any rate, that constant hydrological cycle is going on. You know, if the Earth were billion years old or something like they say, then and nothing has happened since, then all the water from the oceans would soon be deposited up at the poles and it would never come back. And we'd have lower and lower water levels, but in fact the Earth's water levels are rising. And much of that is due to the fact that we have water coming into the planet constantly. So that's another way to gain atmosphere, is through just the constant discharge of the solar capacitor, drawing in material from the solar system. The solar system is moving through the galactic arm, which is has a good quantity of material. The sun itself is discharging the galactic capacitor, acting like a comet in drawing in material. But let me go back to the heat of formation of the planet. Now, when the Earth formed, or in general when planets form, here's what happens. And of course, the cometary atmosphere in a comet is very large, and so as the molecules come in, they actually form larger chain molecules in the cometary system as the electric field of the comet draws these ions and dust particles in, and they start forming larger structures, molecular structures. There's a heat of formation given off, so these come in extremely hot. We have pictures of Hale-Bopp. There's a picture in my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, a picture of Hale-Bopp with 17 arms of water. It was taken by an astronomer in Florida. And these arms are like tentacles out there swinging around. These are extremely hot, triply ionized molecules of water. And it's taken with a Swan filter on a backyard telescope. So this tells you that astronomers do have this kind of data. The little fairy tale puffball, ice ball little model, they're telling you, under real analysis with real equipment, you're seeing an extremely hot streamers of water and other particles coming into that comet nucleus. But the problem is with the small comets, they don't have enough gravitational field, like 67P, they don't have enough gravitational field to hold the material except for dust particles, etc. So the gases and volatiles become neutralized when they hit the electron cloud that's around the comet nucleus. They become neutralized, they blow out with solar wind, and there actually is a term for that. They are called neutrals, because they're neutral, not electrically charged molecules. And they go floating out in solar wind, and that's why astronomers are mistaken when they look at those, and they think that those are neutrals coming off the comet nucleus of a dirty snowball, but what they really are the neutralized ions coming in the comet tail. So going back to the heat of formation, the listener that wrote in the question that I'm answering here wanted to know if it could be electric currents in the nucleus that's building up to become the planet. And by the way, not all comets become planets, so don't misquote me on that. But the bigger ones that are becoming planets, the electrical currents, he wants to know if it was the electrical current that heated up the nucleus. And the answer is no, because the electrical currents flow around the outside. Basically, the nucleus that's forming is a conductor, not a very good one, but it's a conductor, and therefore the field inside that conductor is zero. And so the electrical currents really don't flow inside. They might flow along the surface and around the crust, but the majority of heat comes from literally the chemical heat of formation as the comet draws this material in. And so what's going on is the atmosphere and all the chemicals in the atmosphere are forming and coalescing around this object as it's being formed, Venus being a perfect example of a newly born planet. It already has its atmosphere. It has already all of the hydrogens. It has all the oxygen locked up in different types of chemicals. And when it cools down, eventually it will have all the chemicals it needs to have water. But there's a chemical cooling. I talk about this also in my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, about the chemical cooling that goes on as a planet cools down and becomes, in the case of Venus, who knows how long it's going to take to become a habitable planet. 100 million, 200, a billion years, who knows? I don't know. We don't know. We don't have real data on that. And, of course, we will certainly be much longer in finding those kind of details out, because NASA has reins of all of the equipment and data, etc. But that's a discussion on the heat of formation of planets, where do the atmospheres come from, where do the oceans come from. And, of course, it's an ongoing basis. Venus also, we know, is drawing in material. It acts many times like a comet, drawing in material. We've caught Venus many times on the SOHO satellite, flaring up and acting like a comet. Okay, so once again, remember the water filter, extra GF filters with the shortwave offer number one and the 10-pack of GF filters. Remember that. Go to the sales page, all the information there, and also the new DVD number four and everything else that's on the sales page. Don't forget the Recalendar Sun Star Clock and all the other great products there, unique to my homepage and sales page. The webpage, jmccsci.com, that's seven letters, jmcc, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in indigo.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.